I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. Today, I'm speaking with an old friend, mentor, colleague, one of the women to whom I like to go whenever I'm wrestling with some of life's challenging issues. I've always found that in complex moments that need to be parsed out, deconstructed, analyzed, I've always deeply appreciated your voice. And for those of you who are listening who don't know Florence Butegra, just almost inadequate thumbnail sketch to give you a sense. Florence was the founding CEO of Women Law and Development, WLDAF, in Uganda, which was and is a Pan-African women's rights network and is an expert on the human rights of women, gender and development, governance. After many years of potent activism, moved into the UN system for a time, was the regional program director for UNIFEM in Anglophone West Africa, was the UN women representative to the African Union, was the regional advisor for governance and leadership at UN Women, stationed in Nairobi, and has just spent a lifetime of advocating for women's and girls' rights, understanding both from outside some of the traditional structures and from inside the UN how to move forward the improvement of the human condition for women and girls in particular. Florence, it is wonderful to have you with us today.
Thank you, Irana. I appreciate your kindness in the introduction. It is such a pleasure to be part of this podcast. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I don't think it's fair right now to ask of anyone, what does this precarious moment for global health, for the sustainability of all of the work that's been done around human rights, around development, et cetera, et cetera. So what is the analysis? What do you think is going to happen? But I did think that it'd be interesting to hear at this moment, with everything that you've done, are there thoughts that you're having around what this means for women, for girls, for women's rights, when a crisis like this strikes?
Thank you, Ilana. I would like to speak to that particular point from where I stand, where I sit in Uganda, in Africa, where the numbers of cases of people infected, of people dying, are simply just emerging. But we've paid close attention to what is going on in other countries. And one of the things that comes to mind is the incredible inequality, inequity within our society, both economically, in terms of access to health, in terms of voice, in terms of mobility and ability to respond to difficult situations. So we think of some of the measures that governments are putting in place, like lockdown, like work at home, like homeschooling. In Uganda, the schools are closed, right from kindergarten to university, just like in many other countries. And one woman was sharing with me simple things like she doesn't have a computer at home. Definitely. She doesn't have a desk in her house. She has one room with her three children. So the facilities available is one aspect I'm thinking about that is amplifying the situation of different classes of people being able to respond appropriately. So social distancing and isolation in your place. In Uganda, we have families that have seven people probably living in very small spaces. One of them travels to make a living, comes back and is told you have to isolate yourself. It's not practical. the government right now has like 900 beds for intensive care for isolating people with coronavirus disease in a country of so many millions. So what has struck me is normally when we talk about gender equality or gender inequality and social inclusion, for many people, it sounds very theoretical, like we have these utopia things that are not of immediate concern. The government would like to grow the economy and so on. Now comes something like this and boom, everyone has to stop and say, well, how do we do this? How do we respond to this? So I think it is a challenge for people working on social inclusion and human rights to respond in situations like that. But it is also an opportunity to show clearly that not addressing inequality and equality in situations of calm and normalcy simply lays the ground for failure in situations where effectiveness of action by government, by families, by individual is of utmost urgency. I think that is the one most important thing I've been thinking about. Our president was saying the other day, don't use public means. And I'm like, what? So how are people going to move around? Because that is the only thing they can afford. So by leaving many people behind in terms of socioeconomic development, we lay the groundwork for pandemics like this to take root. And we see this in cases of civil or armed conflict, where many people, both men and women, simply have nowhere to go. They can't survive the conflict because their socioeconomic status, their voice, their whatever prevents them, does not give them a foundation for appropriate responses to protect themselves and to be protected by government.
I find myself thinking similarly that all of the different inequalities that continue are so stark in this moment in a very dangerous and painful way.
You are right. And I think we have to start drawing lessons. What does that mean in terms of the future? How differently? What kind of messaging and arguments for human rights activists, for social justice activists that we have to use to make sure that people in power can understand just how much of a tinderbox structural inequalities are? Oh, we've spoken about this in terms of generality at the national level, at the community level, but the same thing is played out in community. So at the family level, where in spite of the incredible amount of work that many people have put in women's empowerment, in terms of policies that are designed to give women more options, for many, the gendered nature of care responsibilities remain women-focused. So if by any chance a man in a family is struck down sick, he is not going to self-isolate on his own. Not only does he and the community expect his girlfriend, his spouse, his mother, and so on to actually take care of him, the women themselves do know that it is a responsibility to care for them. And we don't have government structures that are going to go into communities to support, to advise. I know there are lots of public information going out on the radio, but without a public health presence in the communities, the women are basically on their own. Products for self-protection are incredibly expensive if they exist. They exist in Kampala, and the prices have doubled. Kampala is our capital city. In the rural areas, they are not there. So people are going to care for others, like in our society it is expected of, without necessarily being able to protect themselves. And that is something that we need to draw lessons from. It's too early for me to say these are the lessons I'm growing in. I'm at the level where I'm thinking, oh my God, this is something that we can't let continue to happen wherever there is a crisis. We have to deal with it. Government has to listen with a different kind of listening lens. But exactly what those messages that are going to be more effective, focused on structural inequalities at the different levels of our communities and our countries, are going to be critically important in terms of drawing from a pandemic like this.
I do feel in this moment that some of the lessons that have been available to us have not resulted in deep structural systemic change, even at the family and community structural level. And I wonder what that means now for activism.
I think we've focused a lot on the individual women's rights and choices, maybe not enough in terms of structural changes, structural inequalities, not in terms of just gender, but taking an intersectional approach and looking at crafting messages that build on what we've learned from these different disasters, whether it is civil war, whether it is diseases like Ebola in Africa, some countries who have had plague, and now where we had SARS in terms of the current pandemic. Generating or rethinking where the focus is. Yes, knowing that we would like to focus on promoting women's rights, equality, and equity, but positioning that in a community, national context. So our analysis is not taking out the woman from that community, because even if she knows her rights, even if she's empowered enough to have voice, real structural change is not going to happen if the situation in which she is in remains unchanged. And I always go back to Paul Freire and his notions of critical thinking, not just by individuals, but within their communities, that we can draw from in terms of the theory and the conceptualization of how we move forward.
One of the things that I've been reading about a little too obsessively, perhaps, is what's happening right now and what the implications will be around funding support. Because let's face it, some of those structural inequalities have also been perpetuated by the way in which funding has flowed from the north, from all of the different funding mechanisms, philanthropy and others, and has made it challenging for community-based organizations, activism, not-for-profits, NGOs, to do the work that they know they need to do and want to do, both at the community level and at the national level. And I've seen some discussion emerging of the need to support local organizations, national organizations, that allows them to drive the agenda, but that also gives great priority to supporting them as organizations so that their survival, their strength in the midst of various crises, when they strike, are an absolute, are part of the agenda, and not just what has been historically a donor-driven imperative or a donor view of what counts as important, meaningful, or generating the results that donors think are credible and important.
Yeah, if those conversations are beginning to happen, that is a positive step. And I hope more development organizations begin to think that way. Generally, in terms of coping mechanisms for their implementing partners in the communities, but really seeing, appreciating that they can play a role. They have always played a role as first responders, as people who know the communities where the crisis is, as people who have connections with the community where support might be necessary. A little bit skeptical, because Ilana, you will know that particularly human rights and social equity organizations are facing serious funding problems. Recently, I was involved in a study of the women's movement in Africa. And one of the aspects that we were looking at was about the funding situation. And almost all the organizations that we reached out to really had problems accessing funds. They had challenges with the modalities of access, this whole idea of bidding for funding created structures within civil society organizations, those who had all the systems, the accounting systems and so on, had better possibility of accessing the funding, and the requirements to access the funds. They have changed the dynamics within the civil society organizations so much. The other thing that was noteworthy, most of the big funding agencies no longer deal with the civil society organizations directly. The funds go to fund managers or to international NGOs who then contract the local organizations and so on. So in terms of policy changes, it seems to me that we need to look at it more holistically and more fundamentally than simply now reacting to the pandemic and saying, okay, how do these organizations, how do we support them? That is very good, but I think there is a bigger question of power relations between the funding organizations and the implementing partners, and their ability to respond to the real needs of the communities. What some of the organizations were telling me is that the initiative for what is to be done in the communities is no longer with them. It is with the funding agency, which will advertise, will call for proposals and so on. So everybody now has to look at, what do I need to do in order to qualify for this funding? I don't know if you understand what I'm saying and how absolutely critical it is that there need to be conversations about power between the development partners in the north, in the east, and on the ground.
I absolutely understand. And I think that that has been something that has been perpetuated and existed for a long, long time. And the need for it to change has always been urgent. I agree. I don't think that the pandemic changes that. This is a bit of a strange segue, but it does make me wonder, Florence, what reflections, what lessons have you taken coming out of the UN structure in terms of that power dynamic as well, and in terms of the access of those whose lived realities are informing the activism, the social justice work? What do you think about it now, having been in the UN system and having left it?
That is a difficult question, one that I'm still kind of struggling with, to try and really be clear in terms of, what did I see? What does it mean? And what lessons do we draw from that? Over the years, as government or political actors exerted a lot of pressure on the United Nations in terms of how it did business, that effort to make it operate like a corporation, I think, changed the dynamics of development. I think trying to use the same principles that business entities use in managing their funding created a dynamic not only within the UN, but in other development organizations. Some of those principles and practices may not be really applicable to development work. One of the most obvious ones is trying to insist on results, quantifiable results, for an organization that is trying to bring about fundamental social change, such as dealing with gender equality. You are trying not only to deal with negative masculinities and a whole system of inequality that is reinforced through education systems, through cultural institutions, through laws, and so on, and comparing it with another organization whose work is perhaps, I don't know which one I can use, like you are immunizing children. It is easy to say, okay, we immunize 10,000 children. You are likely to show the results in that number. Now, trying to show the change on the other side is difficult. So I think one of the areas that I find I'm struggling with is trying to understand what changed, because even the challenges that organizations are finding now in terms of accessing funds are not limited to the private or the government funders. The UN is using exactly the same methods. So I think part of that, the quest for efficiency in development and accountability, perhaps challenging results in terms of how development work is done and how it is financed, and therefore how the civil society and activist groups find themselves responding and trying to do their work, focusing a lot of effort on the form so that they can show the numbers, the formalities, the policies, the whatever, rather than on-ground work in terms of changing attitudes and the cultural values and so on that might result in some structural change. It is something I'm still struggling with.
I too have spent quite a bit of time trying to wrap my mind around it. And what does it mean in terms of how do you change it?
Yeah, that is the question that perhaps as activists, we spent a lot more time trying to conform, to be able to access the funds, to be able to do our work and so on, and not maybe enough conceptual work that could challenge that approach.
My question then is, where did you arrive, Florence? What did you decide to do once you left? How did you move forward?
I think it would be too much for me to claim that I have arrived somewhere. I think it is a conversation that I still have with myself in terms of what do I really want to do? Where can I make a contribution? I am back in Uganda. Women's organizations, activist organizations are doing good work in the midst of a very challenging political environment. I contribute in the conversations in some of the work, but really nothing full-time. I've taken time to work with women at the community level, work with faith-based organizations in the rural community where I spend quite a bit of time, with schools in the area, with the local government in the area, to see whether I can contribute to a revival of community-based advocacy. What happened in many of our communities, definitely in the village where I am, but common to many areas, we had a lot of strong women activists. A lot of them got co-opted into the political structures. You know, we have what we call affirmative action for political participation. And one aspect of that in Uganda is setting up these women councils from the community level to the national level. So that structure, it's like the women's voices have been co-opted to serve a political system. But very interestingly, there is a lot of awareness of rights among the women at the community level. So that has been very interesting for me to be involved in, to contribute to that, and to see how that can be strengthened to link up with the decision makers in the areas. They have a right to demand for services and support from the local government. I serve on the board of governors of two local secondary schools. I use that opportunity to really emphasize and promote girls' education and try to get the schools and the decision makers for the schools, the board of governors, to make sure there are facilities for girls in the school so that girls can stay in school, that the parents are involved and they understand what is it that drives girls out of school so that the dropout rates can reduce in the secondary school. But I'm also a farmer, so using my farming activities as the basis for developing these relationships in the community because I belong. They see me as one of them. Using the farm to introduce improved technologies in agriculture because the community is agriculture-based, so farmers can come and see. I can speak on particular things, how to improve incomes and create employment in the community. And I also participate in some of the conversations at the national and regional level on gender equality and women's rights.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because as I speak to some of my former colleagues at UNIFEM, so many of the women who have traversed those different worlds are finding ways to be involved in different processes, different places where different kinds of conversations are taking place that bring together the different ways of working, different ways of affecting change in people's lives and women's lives.
I think it was part of that work, the engagement with communities and with women's efforts in their communities. That was really part of the most rewarding work during my time with UNIFEM. I think it's one of the inspiration and also recognizing that over the years, there has been quite a lot of achievements in terms of policies, not nearly enough, but here we have policy frameworks that give us room to see if we can take advantage of them and put them in practice so that they don't remain on paper.
I find that very encouraging.
Go for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of this imposed isolation, there's so much horror unfolding and there's so much anxiety and threat. But at the same time, there is an almost hallucinatory slowing down, and it does afford a moment to think deeply on what comes next.
And I think maybe that is a silver lining, that in many cases it affords you an opportunity to almost go beyond the fear of will I go through this and focus your attention on what next.
It's less of a personal what's next, but more of a how do we emerge from this?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so this is just the beginning of a conversation, and I'm hoping that whenever you feel that you have begun to articulate some of the lessons that are coming out of this, that we can have another conversation where maybe conclusions are not being drawn, but perspectives are being formed as we move out of this moment.
Yeah, I hope so too. And that a lot more women who I know are thinking about these things and coming up with brilliant ideas as they always do, will have the opportunity to share and guide all of us together. Our ideas and perhaps assist tackle some of those challenges we've spoken of.
Yes, me too. Okay, so this is just a goodbye for now.
Goodbye, and thank you so much for the opportunity. I've loved speaking with you on this, and hopefully it is something that people can identify with. Thanks, Irana. Yeah.
Thank you, Florence.
Thanks for listening. I'm Irana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com. And come back next week for another episode.